When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. My name is Anthony. This week features Martin's co-author Elio Garcia. Elio and I talk slash argue over a number of topics, but somewhere in there we cover Arya's overhearing of Varys and Ilario's conversation. Elio has a fascinating theory of his own about what that scene was originally meant and how we have to read it differently now that Martin has extended the plot. Steve and I talk slash argue over my least favorite episode. Yes, least favorite episode of the entire HBO adaptation. And I'm including any episodes of season 7 and 8. And for my bird's eye view, I include a short conversation that I had with a fan from Belgium. So without further ado, here is Elio M. Garcia Jr. So, Elio, I'm really interested to hear your take on this chapter. It absolutely is the kind of chapter that you experience differently on a reread.
I absolutely agree with you. It's one, certainly, and especially a reread when you read, if you've read the other books of the series, that like you haven't just, like, I mean, there was a time when the book I reread after reading Game of Thrones was a Game of Thrones, so there wasn't anything else available. Yeah. But once you get further on, once you go further on in the series, you start putting together pieces and you realize that this was a very portentous and very kind of important particular episode towards the greater story of the Song of Ice and Fire, of what's going on behind the scenes that isn't immediately evident.
Let me just do a quick synopsis of the chapter and then we can kind of fill in the details. Arya is chasing cats again. She has designs on an especially cunning Tom when she is confronted by Myrcella and Tommen Lannister. They confuse her for a low-born boy, and a Lannister guard tries to grab her, but Arya is too fast and pushes Tommen to the floor before escaping out a narrow window. She runs through the mazes of the Red Keep until she finds herself in a dark cavern filled with monstrous skulls. Arya steals her courage and runs toward a door to discover a large cistern with a spiraling staircase. She overhears a conversation between two mysterious men. After overhearing several details she can't quite discern, she hides, follows them, and listens a bit more. Finally, she follows a tunnel out of the castle grounds and makes her way back to her father's room. Ned scolds her and refuses to listen to her story. They are interrupted by Yoren, who has news for Ned. Arya leaves wondering if her father's life is in danger. You want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
I suppose in a way it's the ladder of chaos because it is the chaos of creativity and creation. We start getting the story from George of how A Song of Ice and Fire came to be. You know, everyone knows the story of how the first thing he had was finding a dead direwolf in the summer snow, right? Mm-hmm. And that launched him to writing a few chapters, but he was still working in Hollywood. And then he decided to write this trilogy. So he was writing a trilogy.
Just to clue people in who don't know this story. So originally, A Song of Ice and Fire was meant to be a trilogy.
Yeah exactly.
Okay. And then he thought, maybe it's not three books, maybe it's four books, right?
Yeah, and then you know, he launched into the second book, Clash of Kings. And very soon in that process, he realized, well, no, I'm wrong. This is more than four books as well. And he stopped everything. He said he stopped all his work and he started outlining and sort of structuring and thinking of it about exactly how he was going to get. So he said, it's six books. Now, he stuck to six books for a very long time. It's now seven. Maybe it'll be more. I don't know. I can't say anything. I won't say anything about that. But basically, around the time of the second book, he said, okay, it's no longer a trilogy, it's no longer four books, it's six books. And he's created a pretty broad plan, but he's trying to stick to as best he can. So, A Game of Thrones is a book that was born out of that initial trilogy, and at the end of it, he thought, "Ah, it's running a little long. I'll cut off some of it and I'll put it at the start of the next book." But what always struck me about this particular bit is how was George going to make the whole story move that quickly? What did he think was going on? What is it are the things that he added when he said, "Okay, it's six books. I need to add. I mean, I know I have like the main story threads that I wanted to do. They're going to take longer than I thought. So I have to fill in gaps. I have to create additional plots to kind of fill in the story." And around the year, about 1999, 2000, we're communicating with George regularly on our website because we're doing heraldry. We're doing, we're answering questions. We're kind of pointing out mistakes. And he sometimes, like, he's using us for to help him, like, remember details that he had written earlier and all that stuff. And he said, I just got around to completing the Targaryen family tree, because when he started Game of Thrones, he had started writing, and then he said, "I'll create the list of kings and I'll drop down the little details," but he didn't have a whole family tree. And
And
this is after,
it's something of a tangled family tree.
extremely, it's an extremely incestuous, the Julio-Claudians have nothing on them. And another thing that kind of develops out of that, and it has to do with the Hedge Knight, which is a novella written in the, which is a prequel kind of to As Always in Fire, is he creates the whole Blackfyre thing, right? The Blackfyres. The Blackfyres did not exist prior to sometime around the end of Clash of Kings and the start of the Writing of
So
Swords.
one of the things that made him think this is bigger than I thought was the sort of the Blackfyre pretenders that we meet toward the end of Dance. I guess we meet throughout Dance, right?
Well, at least we believe there, there is the possibility that maybe we're not. But I fall on the side that George is drawing. I saw As a Fire started a little bit as a kind of a Wars of the Roses made into a fantasy. And if you know the history of the Wars of the Roses, you did have pretenders show up pretending to be one of the princes in the tower, and so on. So I think George said, "Okay, great. I'll draw from that. I'll have a pretender prince, and that'll be part of the story." So this pretender prince, when we discover, when Tyrion meets Illyrio, and he learns about, he's gonna go meet Griff, and then he meets his young Griff, who is apparently Prince Aegon, the son of Rhaegar. And all these details around him. And I said, "Okay, well, wait a second. George didn't invent any of that when he was writing A Game of Thrones. He had no idea about it."
There's no way Arya could have overheard any of those details in this conversation because those details have not been invented yet, right?
Exactly. So, but then the question is what is this? What are they doing? I think Varys and Illyrio's role in the initial trilogy and what Arya overhears is perhaps very different from what George, the gardener, ended up developing out of them. So to me, like this is like one of the most intriguing pieces of the puzzle about what the story would have been to begin with. And I have, I have this notion personally, and this is again, I want to clarify because I've never discussed this with George. I don't have any insight beyond the things that he has told
So
everybody
this is an
already.
Elio Garcia independent thought.
Absolutely independent. My belief is that George's initial idea was that Varys and Illyrio were going to tie into the others and the White Walker, that they were wittingly or unwittingly puppets of who's ever attacking from beyond the
Oh
wall,
my
and
goodness.
that they were destabilizing the realm just in time for the White Walkers to be ready to make their attack.
That's so interesting.
That's my idea. And I have some elements that I think may tie into it. A Clash of Kings, as I mentioned, George was starting to write it, and then he kind of paused to flesh out his six book arc of it. Or, and we have in this in the Clash of Kings, we have Tyrion talking to Varys and Varys talking about the occasion in which he was gelded and turned to a eunuch. And that a sorcerer in the Three Cities did it, threw his member into fire, and the fire turned to blue flame, and this strange, frightening voice came out of it. He doesn't know what happened. I think this is a remnant of what George was going with, that somehow Varys had sorcerous contact as a child, perhaps even been affected by this sorcerer contacting the others. That's my idea.
So that basically... it's an interesting. All right, so let's talk about some of the little details here that would support this particular suggestion. So we are assuming, and I think we assume correctly, that Arya overhears Varys and Ilario talking.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely. I think the best evidence, other than Ilario, I mean the description of this very fat figure wearing
fat,
rings,
a forked yellow beard. He's got the Free Cities accent.
I believe there's also a mention of his walking, which is a detail that I think Tyrion.
He walks on the balls of his feet
because he used to be a water dancer.
Oh right? Interesting, excellent. All right. And of course, Varys, I mean, he talks about little birds and he seems to know everyone's business. And we know he loves disguises. And interesting that he's called a sorcerer, whether that's tongue in cheek or not.
Yeah.
So I think that we're pretty on safe ground with that.
Absolutely.
But then the second thing to note here is that timing seems especially important to these two. Varys basically says, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing, I always say Varys, I hear you saying Varys, and I'm thinking, well, normally I wouldn't think twice, but now I'm talking to Elio Garcia.
that's a funny one. Yeah. To be honest, we were reading these books before we ever contacted George, and then when we contacted George, it was all emails, so we developed all our pronunciations long before we talked to George. And so even now people are telling us, why do you keep calling him Stannis, not Stannis or whatever it is? And it's like, well, this is how we've always said it. And at the time George said, you know, say however you want. There's no pronunciation guide for a reason. Just say whatever's comfortable. So
that's funny. I teach ancient languages. And so I tell my students, just pronounce it however you want to pronounce it. These are ancient languages. We have guesses about how they are pronounced, but anyway, so Varys says something along the lines of, I can forestall this a little bit, maybe, but I'm not going to be able to hold back the tide. The lion and the wolf are going to be right at each other's throat, like, pretty soon. You know, it could be a couple days, it could be a week, but Ned's absolutely going to find out the truth, and that's going to start a war. And Ilario's basically saying, you got to delay. You've got to delay. We're not ready for war yet. All right. So that much, I think, we can sort of chalk up to fact that these two they absolutely want to use a war to their benefit.
Right.
But the question about that is the timing. There's the timing of the war is crucial.
Exactly.
All right. So then building from that, of course, we have to ask the question, why? Why do these two think that the timing of a civil war will benefit them? Right. And I think that maybe as the story progresses, it benefits them because there's this Blackfyre intrigue that they have to put in place because they want to put a hidden Targaryen on the throne, something like that.
Right.
But you're suggesting that could not be the case because George has not invented that yet.
Yeah, that's exactly my view. I don't think that I am certain. I mean, for example, if you read The Hedge Knight, there's not a whisper, there's not a hint that the Blackfyre has ever existed. It's not until the second story after George has already fleshed all the details out. Where the Blackfyres are mentioned. A Storm of Swords is the first reference to it. When he said he finished a family tree, I mean, he sent us that family tree back then. And we saw this Blackfyre thing, and we saw Aegor Rivers, Bittersteel, for the first time. Oh, for that matter, we saw Rhaenyra Rivers for the first time in that tree. So George did not have them in mind until he didn't quite... Rhaenyra Rivers is a whole other thing about the shape of the story, of course, because...
Right.
if he didn't exist. I actually talked to George about this particular point. Like, I knew that he hadn't created a family tree, and yet Brendan Rivers is going to have this big role in the sort of the magical side of the story. And I asked him, like, you didn't have him, like, did you, or did you have him and you just didn't figure out how he worked? He said, well, and he actually answered and said, I knew it would be someone like him. I didn't really know any of the details. It would be
Interesting.
someone like him that would exist who would be connected to the Three-Eyed Crow
Right.
beyond the wall. So yeah, it, to me, it's if that's not it, what's happening? The timing is matters because it's clear that they're planning to use, I think, Viserys and Daenerys as an initial wedge into this conflict, into
Right.
what they want to do. But I think the whole point is to do something. Illyrio, to be honest, my view of this is like when I read Illyrio and I consider how Illyrio is, he may not be in the same position as Varys. I could see them like him believing that Varys and he are tight and they know exactly what each other is planning. And in fact, Varys is using Illyrio because of whatever's going on. Magically or whatever. But certainly we see this early on in the first Dany chapter, I believe, or maybe the second, in A Game of Thrones, where she thinks about, I think the first one where Illyrio kind of calms Viserys down, tells her how everyone's waiting to hail him as a king, and she says, she could see his sly smiles. He didn't respect Viserys. He was just using Viserys for his own purposes. So I think all of that is correct to. And George continued to use that even as a story ended up shaping differently. And Varys and Illyrio ended up having what I think was a different role. They're still having a role where you're still trying to destabilize the realm. But now it's my view is Varys is putting into practice the idea that you can what matters is, in the nature versus nurture, it's like 100% nurture in his view. You can make a king, you can train someone to be a king.
Right.
And if you train them, if you raise them from infancy, saying you are Prince Aegon, who's to say they aren't actually Prince Aegon, right? It's
Right, sure.
all so it's really interesting because it's such a big change. And I one of the most fascinating things is when it goes further is I don't know, there was I think it was with Conan O'Brien. Did you see that there was a the Game of Thrones show did like a post Game of Thrones thing with Conan,
I haven't
I
seen that,
think.
no.
And they had Conliff Hill as one of the people, they had all the cast and Conliff Hill shared something that George told him about Varys, like a
Oh, I've seen
fundamental,
this, that
yeah,
he's
that bit.
ultimately like he has good intentions or something like that.
Yeah. Which is a very interesting. I mean, I must have gold and another 50 birds.
Right.
That line kind of runs through your head, like what the this is obviously someone who I guess in George's view, he is someone who is the ends justify the means. Perhaps I think there's a lot of I think a lot of people may have arguments about whether morally Varys can be actually fundamentally good when you consider what the birds are and what's being done to
Yeah, and he wants them, he keeps on, he says, I want them especially young, right?
exactly.
There's something like, look, I need to train these, the sort of the spy network from the time that they're tiny creatures, which, you think about his own childhood and how young he was when he was used by the evil men of his own society. I think that Varys is something like, sort of the ends justify the means when it comes to these things. He says, what I can do, I will. The one with the torch said softly, I must have gold and another 50 birds. So, in other words, Ilario is funding whatever Varys is doing. Ilario is funding, and he's also providing him with children to the tune of 50 at a time. It's kind of disgusting when you think about it. So, all right, yeah, that's gosh, it's interesting to me that he's looking at the chessboard and he's not really putting any pieces in place yet, but the chessboard has to look just right before he decides to enter the game.
Yeah, that's and it's really interesting when you think about one of the things that many people assumed with There's an earlier bit of dialogue, you know, if one hand can die, why not a second?
Yes.
You have danced the dance before, my friend. A lot of people did obviously read this initially in for Game of Thrones as, oh, well, they must be the ones behind the death of Jon Arryn. Obviously, this is intentional from George, leaving it a mystery, giving you different. There's two kind of primary, well, there's three, I guess, technically, sort of views you can have on it, which is like there's Varys and Illyrio, and they're talking about it, kind of. But a hand has died, and you dance this dance
Yeah,
before.
suggesting that Varys had something to do, or maybe he was the person behind the death of Jon Arryn, right?
And then there's the, you know, Cersei did it, which is the obvious one, but the Starks kind of focus on. It seems obvious to them that the Lannister, and they just don't understand why, and they end up, you know, Ned ends up discovering why it happened, he thinks. And then we are later told in A Song of Swords a different narrative, which is very different. Basically, it makes it all seem more of a tragic, not an accident, but since it was a poisoning, but it was someone. There's someone else who's actually moving chess pieces around,
Yeah. Well,
and
okay, so Jon Arryn, I mean, we have at least three different motives. One is Cersei has a motive to keep her secret so that her son remains a legitimate Baratheon on the throne. You've got Varys because if we know that Jon Arryn was against trying to assassinate Dany. And so then the question is that stand behind it? Does Varys have a motive here to destabilize and control Robert and therefore he get Jon Arryn out of the way? And then of course what we find out later is that Lysa Arryn wants her husband dead because she wants to be with her love Littlefinger, and Littlefinger wants to sow chaos, and so those two are behind it. So, I mean, I've kind of been working from the assumption that Lysa is beyond it, and that is why sort of Martin drops this little hint that they're called the Tears of Lys, sort of as a literary, just a little literary breadcrumb. Not that the in-world Tears of Lys were named after Lysa or vice versa, but that sometimes Martin likes to drop these little breadcrumbs that don't mean anything at the time, but then you go back and you like, oh, I see. He's got something in mind here.
Well, I mean, in a similar vein, I mean, we go to the Vale of Arryn in Catelyn's chapter, and what do we see there? Alyssa's tears, the waterfall. So that could be another. Yes, it's interesting that George is playing. I mean, and you know, it's absolutely true that George will play around with certain sounds and names, reusing them. If you've read his other works and says, you know, his Thousand Worlds, there's a Geoffrey Lion, which you can kind of see a Joffrey and a Lannister kind of thing going. He does reuse certain. I mean, there's a Song for Lyanna, which has a Rob and a Lyanna, which is obviously many talk. Rob Stark, Lyanna,
Oh,
George.
yeah.
George does reuse things, so I mean the idea that it might amuse him, it might work to his sort of authorial creative mind to kind of sow seeds in the language he uses is not far off. I think there's a point to be made there. I mean, it's absolutely the case that Lysa did it because of Littlefinger. I mean, Littlefinger definitely had a big role in suggesting it and helping her do it. I don't see where else she would have gotten that poison, since the Maester seemed entirely unaware what was going on. So to me, I mean, it's such a perfect mystery that George did with the death of Jon Arryn, because he does such a good job of laying out different possibilities and leaving it, seeding so many little hints along the way. So when he gets you at the end and you realize it's not, for many people, didn't quite, but they go, oh, of course. Because he revealed that there were things with Lysa's story that didn't make sense, and now they do as soon as you retrospectively look at it. So Varys, but I mean, going back to Varys and Illyrio, I mean, at this stage, when you think, oh yeah, they must have had a role in it, but it's directly contradictory to what they're saying right now. But they don't want a war happening right now. They want to delay it. And why is the war happening? I believe Varys says, you know, the hand has the book, and it's only a matter of time
Yeah, he's got the
before he
book
figures
and the
out.
bastard, and it could be a day, it could be 2 days, but it could be a fortnight. But It's absolutely Ned's absolutely going to find out the truth at some point, and it'll probably be soon. I have a question for you, and it's a question that I get asked by lots of people, and I never have a good answer for it. But maybe you will, because you ask George these kinds of questions. So this is more of a question about how much of a gardener is... how much of a gardener are we actually dealing with here? So here's the question that I get asked. All right, so George has seen how the show's story arcs concluded and how that was received. How much will that... Let's just call that like the world's largest focus group. All right? So the world's largest focus group has been tested. But I guess the question is this. After the world's largest focus group has sort of given the verdict that this is how we've received season, you know, the outcome of the Song of Ice and Fire, is George the type of gardener who will think, maybe I'll go a different direction. I'll take a different course of action here to see where that goes. Or is he the kind of gardener that's kind of stubborn that says, nope, that's my outline. My story only works this way. I'm going to continue going, and I'm going to tell the story in a way that's satisfying to me. So do you have any insights into that at all? Like, do you think that George will change the ending based on this giant focus group that happened at the end of season 8?
No. But I George has said all along, he has the end in mind. He's always had the end in mind. From the time it was originally a trilogy, I guess he had a sense. Certainly by the time he did that fuller outline for the 6 books, he knew kind of the major beats for some of these characters. What I will say, I think, is that think about how often he talked about the show needing more time. You know, 10 seasons, 12 seasons would have been good for him. It wasn't just trying to buy time for writing his book. It was also because they were cutting down out things which were, in his mind, integral to how the ending happens.
Yeah, okay.
And a big complaint of a lot of people who I stopped watching after season 5. I just know I know what happened because I live on the internet, but the main complaints I saw is that some of the developments in that final set of episodes felt so rushed and sudden, like it came out of, and they are saying, oh, it didn't come out of nowhere. We had hints here and there, but I think what people reacted to is they didn't feel like there was a core of emotional truth to, in particular, what happened with Daenerys. They didn't feel that where she went fits the arc of her character up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
George has, I think, laid the seeds for it in a way that are, I mean, even in Dance of Dragons, her final chapter, where she thinks about how her mistake was trying to make peace and trying to be peaceable. She's a dragon. Dragons are for war. That's a really interesting, because to me it's like it's very foreboding as well, because you're starting to see it shaping in her head that she's not there to be a peaceful queen. She's a queen for war and a queen for fire and blood.
Mm-hmm.
And that will have, I think George's intention is that the next books, book 6, book 7, if there needs to be book 8, will start giving you chapters in her head showing that develop more and more and progress to where she's at a point where you could perhaps see what happens at the end of the TV show happening to her in a way that feels much more earned.
Don't let me put words in your mouth, but what I'm hearing is that George has outcomes in mind, and we can probably take it to the bank that he's not going to change anyone's outcome. It's just that the way that George will get these characters to their ultimate outcome will be in a way that's satisfying to George, And we'll have to wait and see if it's satisfying to the fans.
I think that's fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Elio, season six is one of my favorite seasons of the show. I don't know if you would ever consider revisiting the HBO adaptation.
I have heard that season six was an improvement over season five. But then I hear about season seven and eight for many people.
Absolutely. I mean, but let's also keep in mind that the numbers only ever increased. The numbers That's for true. Watchers. I mean, there is a lot of vocal people on the internet, but the numbers only ever got bigger. So they were doing something and I will say that this, even though season eight was largely panned, there were moments in season eight that were just gorgeous. And I thought, for me, I can kind of view those final seasons as an iteration in the way that maybe like a fan fiction could be like an iteration of the outcome of a story. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed them for what they are. It doesn't necessarily ruin the story arcs that came before. But I was always just in it for the fun anyway.
Yeah. So. No, I think what really started becoming more obvious as a show went on. I mean, I became the second season was the first kind of inkling that maybe this isn't going to be as going in the way that I want. But I mean, I was happy with second and third, but I think a lot of it is adaptation is a conversation, I guess, between those adapting and the creator, and it's what the adapters take out of it and what they choose to focalize that becomes what we receive as viewers of their work, of their creation. And I felt as time went on that David and Dan, and this may possibly be the influence of just the nature of making film and television in Hollywood. Mm. And they were very spectacle focused.
Yes. I think I
can totally buy that there were some really amazing moments, but I think that that's because David and Dan were focused on moments. There was a critic, I think it's Miles McNutt, who talked about this. Or maybe it was Emily Vandorf. I don't know. Some critics talked about it, but they felt that what they felt, and I felt that this is what led me to stop kind of watching, is that they were so focused on hitting these spectacular moments. I mean, there's famous image from the final episode of Daenerys coming down the steps and Drogon's wings coming out, and yeah, he looks like his wing demon. And everyone talked about the beauty of the composition and how amazing. And to me, it's like, it's a great image, but it's like taking a hammer and just whacking you over the head with what they're trying to say. Uh-huh. Cause you can see that they love that image, but they loved the image so much that it didn't matter to them whether they were just thumping you on the head, uh-huh, or if they were trying to be subtle. And I feel like, to me, that's what made me disenchanted towards the end. And I think that's what makes it different. Like, I mean, if you look at Feast for Crows, the reception for Feast for Crows among critics at the time, I think that was really positive. I mean, George got his Time magazine was talking to him as America's Tolkien on the strength of A Feast for Crows. Because to me, as interestingly enough, Feast for Crows, despite how difficult its Genesis birth was, in some ways, it's the most sort of almost literary of the novels.
Yeah.
Because it is so, the theme of the Feast for Crows, of the spiraling down, the destruction, the corruption, the falling apart of society, yeah, runs through everything. Everything has it, from the melancholy of the captain of the guards opening chapter, where Prince Doran is sitting there and you can practically smell the blood oranges falling to the ground, and he's waiting for something, he's waiting for word, but his brother has been killed, all the way through to Jaime at the end burning his sister's letter. He doesn't want to help her.
Yeah.
All of those things had such a cohesion to them. And they weren't about moments. They weren't about shocking you with the next big spectacle. It was a much more character-focused approach. I think that's a big difference.
I hear what you're saying, and I think, for the most part, I do agree. I think that the question is whether or not you're still emotionally connected to the story. Like, for me, that moment when Dany walks down the stairs and you see Drogon's wings behind her, it worked for me. Oh, man, it worked for me. Because I'm still emotionally connected, where I think a lot of fans were like, they were pretty pissed that the way that Dany's character went. From the very beginning, I thought, with Dany, when she sees a problem in the world and she wants to fix it, her method for trying to fix that problem is to grasp for more power so that she can control the bad guys. And I always think, well, that's a very Targaryen move. You know, you see a problem in the world and now you're going to grasp for more power so that you can throw back the bad. That's the kind of move that someone like Miri Mazdoor is going to absolutely critique. So I don't know. I always thought with Dany that was sort of, she was going to become something of a tyrant from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think that a lot of fans didn't like that about her. They wanted Dany to, in the end, be a benevolent dictator. And I didn't think that was going to be an option for her.
No, I agree with you on that point. I definitely think a lot of people didn't have a real sense of where the story's going. As I said, I mean, that Dance of Dragons chapter at the end, that's George. That's about as clear as George can get without hitting you over the head with it, that she started to think in that direction, but that doesn't work for her to try to do things. So to me, I think for most fans who did get that, who were still unhappy with it, it's just the sense that it was rushed, I think. But it didn't feel like they did. I mean, even to the point where they were proud of the fact, I think there was interviews talking about the fact, like, you know, Emilia saying, I didn't understand certain scenes and how they wanted me to play her. And I was trying to ask for information and they just said, play it as we wrote it. And basically they were just trying to say, oh, well, let's convey that she has this dragon-like ferocity in her and this tyranny inside her heart. But let's not tell our actress that. Let's just tell her just to play. And I mean, I think some of the stuff that I think are just mistakes that new producers make. Some of it, I think, are signs that they maybe didn't think through their relationship with their actors and what actors are. They aren't actors themselves, they're writers. They don't, you know, so for writers, characters do what they want them to do, and that's it. There's no arguing. If your character doesn't argue with you, well, sometimes they do. Some writers talk about characters that way, but they don't argue with them and they'll have to kind of listen to them. But that's just a very writerly exercise. But I think there's aspects of where like I kind of wonder if someone else had been running the show, could it have gone differently? Or if someone who just wanted to continue running the show for a few more seasons was handling it.
Yeah, could if they a few had passed seasons... it off to someone else. I honestly do feel like if there was a fan who was really great at editing and came in and just used the material that the showrunners have provided with season 6 through 8, I think that you could probably, in the editing room, come up with a pretty decent conclusion to that story. Not one that George would have envisioned.
No.
One that just has the character beats just evolve in a little differently. You know, I think one more episode in season 8 really might have done it for me with Daenerys.
Yeah,
that's how I feel. But maybe I'm in the minority here. I loved, there's so much about those seasons that I loved that I was willing to forgive the sort of unforced errors that they brought to it.
Yeah, no, I could certainly see the point. I mean, I certainly didn't feel that. I mean, I think people can't just ignore the fact that it was the most, you know, watched and talked about show on the planet for a certain point. Like it is what it is. They struck a chord. Mm-hmm. They were able to hold on to people, but sometimes things can strike a chord that perhaps have their flaws. I mean, even a song like The Fire has its flaws, even though it strikes a chord with people. As someone who didn't watch it, I have a sense of why those who disliked it. I know why critics were panned, but at the same time, I can definitely see why people enjoyed it, even people who recognize that it was flawed.
Let me just, in a short time we have remaining, I want to revisit the chapter.
Oh, yes.
So I'm going to read this little passage here, and I want to sort of throw my immediate reaction at you and see what you say. This is Arya is hiding in the dark. She hunkered down in the dark against a damp stone wall and listened for the pursuit. But the only sound was the beating of her own heart and the distant drip of water. Quiet as a shadow, she told herself. She wondered where she was. When she had first come to King's Landing, she used to have dreams about getting lost in the castle. So now she's going to recount her dreams. Father said the Red Keep was smaller than Winterfell, but in her dreams it had been immense, an endless stone maze with walls that seemed to shift and change behind her. She would find herself wandering down gloomy halls past faded tapestries, descending endless circular stairs, darting through courtyards or over bridges, her shouts echoing unanswered. In some of the rooms, the red stone walls would seem to drip blood, and nowhere could she find a window. Sometimes she would hear her father's voice, but always from a long way off, and no matter how hard she ran after it, would grow fainter and fainter until it faded into nothing and Arya was alone in the dark. Number one, as I read that, it's written a little bit like a horror scene. A scene in like a horror novel. And then I think because Ned's voice features and then fades in that section, I wonder if George is foreshadowing Ned's ultimate death. What do you think about that?
Ned's voice features somewhere else.
She says she's going through the castle and like some of the rooms are like covered in blood. So King's Landing is a dangerous and ominous place, right? A place of mazes, and she's calling for her father's voice, and she can hear her father's voice, but it's always distant, and she can never get an answer, and then finally it fades into nothing.
Right.
And I wonder if this is sort of George's way of foreshadowing Ned's death.
I think so. I think absolutely. I mean, in Bran's chapter, when they hear of the death of Ned, I mean, they have to go down into the crypts, and Rickon is there because he had
the same
father.
Dream.
He had spoken. Yeah. He had dreamed that his father was coming. I think they spoke.
Yeah.
Bran didn't remember what they spoke about. But so the voice of Ned's presence is so important to his children that, of course, it seems to have some sort of psychic quality, some magical quality that leads them to sort of. It's absolutely the horror thing. I mean, George is a master, I think, of the mood that he sets it in his stories. And this, I mean, this whole passage is a beautiful piece of writing, I think. And George is able to use it to create hints to make you start thinking, like, even if you don't, you're reading in the moment, she's lost, you're kind of caught up. Most people just go on, breeze right past that, continue on to what happens next. What's going to happen to Arya?
Yeah.
But it's there in the back of your head somewhere. That language is floating back there of his voice fading away, and you won't forget it. And when he dies, and then when you get that echo from Bran learning from Master Luwin, they have to find a sculptor who knows their father's likeness, because Rickon had that, and they both had that dream. They spoke to him. No, absolutely. I think George does it. He does it with so many characters are foreshadowed in their fates. Catelyn staring into Renly's armor in A Clash of Kings and seeing a drowned woman. There's so many of those. So no, absolutely. I think George absolutely knew, even if he was changing the story as he went, that Ned was dead. This was a central feature of his first novel, which that he wanted to have a protagonist that you rooted for, but you were attached to, and then he was going to kill him. Because he was going to show that he wasn't playing games, that he was playing for keeps.
I love that passage. I think you're right. It is beautifully written, and it really does give you the sense that the Red Keep is this dangerous, haunted place. You also get the sense that in that chapter, Arya is in the room with all of the dragon skulls, and she says that she knows that they're dead. But there's something that is there. There's a presence there that does not love her. And you get the sense, okay, what am I, how should I read this? Should I read this as, well, dragons are magic and there's like some sort of dark magic down there where all those dragon skulls are? Or is it just the way Arya's feeling, and you could read it both ways, but it does the same thing. It really does. It brings you to this idea that there's this King's Landing is something of a haunted place, and that's how we should look at it from a Stark perspective. Dangerous, haunted place.
I think that's a great observation because, I mean, a lot of the story is haunted by the ghosts of a Targaryen's past, the people in the past, who, you know, the Mad King, Rhaegar looms. Daenerys has her own vision of, in her dreams, of what King's Landing is like. I didn't think about this, but until we discuss it, but I mean, we talk about King's Landing as labyrinthine.
Yeah.
Maze of things. I think also, of course, George kind of revisits a similar kind of feel in Clash of Kings with Daenerys when she's among the warlocks and I think she even hears voices distantly but trying to lead her away, and there's these passages, constant endless passages, she keeps trying to find her way through it. So that's definitely an image that George finds resident. There's a story from years back, one of his Thousand World stories called The Stone City, which I highly recommend. It's a great short science fiction story about this enormous ancient city in which the main character ends up being kind of running away from some trouble he's in, and he gets lost, and it's this maze, and you feel that there's ghosts there, not literal, but you can imagine it. You can feel like there's something eerie about it. And George is so good at just creating this sense of eeriness and making it part of the thematics of what's going on in the story. So I think the Red Keep really captures that in this passage, because George really wants to get you into sort of Arya's mindset, try to see it through her world and feel what she's feeling. And so the language, the choice of how he describes things kind of gives you that. As I said, I think he's really a master at sort of the atmosphere of things. It's one of the things, like, my favorite chapters tend to be just really heavy with the atmosphere, because George is just really capable of evoking these feelings, whatever. It's the pit of the stomach of when poor Quentin Martell is trying to work up the nerve to try and steal a dragon, and you just feel like it's going to go wrong. You can tell, you know it. He practically knows it.
Yes.
But... he's so good at it. He's so good at it.
Yeah. So one of the things that we do with this podcast is we talk about the show differences, and we talk about any major introductions. In both cases, when Arya's downstairs, it really is the first introduction to, you know, the physical presence of dragons, even though it's just skulls. Yeah. You know, we've heard about dragons. Tyrion reads about dragons. We've heard about the uses of dragon bone, and we've met Dany's eggs already and whatnot. But in this, absolutely real. These are not creatures out of myth in George's world. These are artifacts of dragons that are, you know, enormous, and their teeth are like swords and whatnot. So introduction to, you know, actual dragons for the first time.
Yeah.
And then the show difference that struck me the most was that Arya really does hide in one of these skulls to overhear the conversation. The conversation is much shorter. There's less detail in the conversation, for sure. The dragon skulls feature so prominently in the show that it's almost like you've done a lot to make that room feel, you know, believable.
Yeah.
Why not just have the whole scene in that room? Right. So
yeah, that's a really good choice, because the economy of things is a lot that mattered for them at certain times. When they make a set, it's not a one-off set. It's something you're going to use multiple times. And then when they made those skulls were featured, you know, they had various exhibitions that they did for props and costumes. Yeah, and the dragon skulls were always kind of present as one of the big things to show off. The one difference there, it's kind of funny, but I've never understood why we didn't make the skulls black.
Yeah, they're supposed to be black. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I never asked them why they stuck to this sort of a bone color, but I think it would have been interesting to see them all black, and it would have looked. I mean, we see that when we looked at sort of you go to a museum and you look at a reconstructed dinosaur skeleton or whatever, they tend to be these dark bones. I don't know. It's one of those weird things.
Yeah.
One other thing about this chapter, I think this is the first chapter in which Arya is mistaken to be a boy.
Yeah, interesting.
Tommen does it, and then the guard does it, and Maisie Williams.
Even Yoren does it toward the end. Yoren's like, "You must be, this must be your son, right?"
Yeah,
he has
which
your
is very
look.
Important. Which is very important towards her last chapter in the book as well. Right. That was a great. I mean, reading a Game of Thrones of reading the end of her chapter. For the first time and not knowing, so waiting for Clash of Kings and not knowing what happens next. Quite the thing. As this menacing figure of a knife keeps calling her boy, boy, and like, oh my God.
All right, man. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, much appreciated. Really great talking to you.
All right.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I talk about episode 3 of season 4. This is Breaker of Chains. This is when Sansa escapes with Dantos. Sam sends Gilly away. Daario is Dany's champion. And then you have this horrific scene between Jaime and Cersei in the Sept of Baelor. Here is comic Steve Osborne.
Steve, this is my least favorite Game of Thrones episode.
Wow. Okay.
I have not watched the last season for a while. It's probably been over a year since I watched the last season. And there were a couple dogs in that season. So It's hard to say, but this has got to be my top three at least.
Really?
Yeah.
Go on.
Oh, well, I got all kinds of things to talk about. Let me rapid fire through the things I didn't like, and then we can kind of get it out of the way. We begin with Joffrey's face.
You sure? Okay. Yeah, just when you thought you were out of the woods.
That's right. I thought we were done with Joffrey's face.
No, that's true. Yeah, I think Heather's, if I can quote her correctly, it was,
The Sansa escape seemed a little bit Disney to me, and I think it might have been the music, but it all seemed a little bit like, I know, young adult fiction, kind of, I don't know, just kind of tiptoeing through the city and, you know, getting on a boat and all of that business. They get in the boat, and then, like, all of a sudden it's foggy? It's like it's a clear day, and then, of course, you know, Littlefinger shows up and brings a blanket of fog with him just because he's so mysterious or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in a world of smoke babies and dragons, fog is really the hang-up. Yeah,
I mean, I've spent a lot of my life around boats and ocean, and I know that a fog can come, you know, fog can roll in pretty quickly.
Sure.
Under the right conditions. But I don't know. I thought that was
a Resurrection? Little... No problem. Fog, no problem. Come on, man.
No problem. In general, Danto sucks. I just think he just as a character, as an actor.
Well, you don't need him very much. He does what he needs to do.
He did what he needed to do, but he really sucks. And then
just that strong feeling towards Danto.
I just don't like Dantos. And
so you should like this episode because he dispatched fairly quick.
Well, he gets it right in the face.
Right in the face. Like everything that you're complaining about, it resolves immediately.
Yeah. All right. I will say that I was just starting to like Jaime and like the Hound.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So
this will be a good talking point then.
All right. I was liking those two characters, and I liked the Hound a little bit less at the end of this episode, and I like Jaime a lot less at the end of this episode.
Sure.
I
think that's okay. I think that that's super important.
Mm-hmm. Sam and Gilly. Sam is he's returning to his cowardly ways.
Well, that's kind of Sam's thing. Is he just now catching up to this character?
This is
great. This you and I are gonna have a lot to talk about.
Okay, great. I'm okay with Davos. I think Davos may be the only.
I think that's the epitome of Davos' opinion, right?
I'm okay with Davos.
Who's out there like, oh man, I'll tell you what. Oh, thank God it's a Davos episode.
I'll tell you what about Davos. He's one of the few characters that's just good. He's a good guy, yeah. Right?
Sure seems like it. Sure seems like it.
He's just an ethical man in a sea of mediocrity and terror. But I think that maybe he's not as complicated as he should be because of that. I don't know. Maybe
that's... Well, I think that that's the beauty of it, right? Is like there's a certain element of like anytime we see somebody who seems to have a, you know, maybe a heightened sense of ethics, take your pick on a start.
Yeah.
They're dispatched fairly quickly. And this guy has had every opportunity to do that. In fact, he's ethicking himself right into harm's way all the time. And then he keeps getting spared by the people that are trying to kill him. And so it's like the complication of his narrative is like, he should be dead by now.
Yeah, he should be dead like four times over.
Yeah. Right?
But I feel like his argument with Stannis, they've had like nine times.
Yeah.
You know, I'm done with the argument at this point. I was really...
So the argument is to you what any torture scene for Theon is to me.
Yeah, I could do with a couple more torture scenes and a few less conversations about the Lord of Light. I was really invested in this Oberyn-Tywin face-off. And this kind of threw a wet... I felt like this episode threw a wet blanket over it. Like, Tywin's just gonna... They're just gonna sort of make an alliance. And I wasn't super happy about that. Lady Olenna was a bright spot. I always liked Lady Olenna. I thought she was great. But anyway, I had enough other things that I didn't care about. And in addition to that, we see Jaime rape Cersei. And that probably colored my opinion of the entire episode.
Yeah, I will say that there's an interesting element of that rape scene. Because it's rape. I don't know if I'm supposed to interpret it as...
Okay, this was a big deal when it happened, because the director, Alex Graves, basically came out and said, I didn't think it was rape. I mean, that's not how I feel like I directed the scene. And everyone else was like, dude, that's rape. So it contributed to rape culture in that way, just because the director kind of unwittingly thought that...
Sure.
Yeah, anyway.
I feel like he's trying to direct it in such a way that it's Cersei being like, maybe not in front of Joffrey.
So it's interesting because it reads less... I'll have to go read this passage again in the books. I haven't read it in a while, but if I remember correctly, Cersei... She says they shouldn't do it in front of the gods. She feels a little bit weird, like, dude, we're in a church. Like, the gods are watching us. But, I mean, the way that Graves interprets this whole thing, that's pretty jarring. That scene was pretty jarring. So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, no, that's fair.
So what do you want to talk about? I feel like I said my piece.
All right. Well, we'll catch you next episode. I know here's what I think is important about the about Jaime and the Hound and how you feel about them. And this caused a very lengthy conversation between Heather and I, because Heather's still very much in the, if you're Jaime and you're rooting for redemption, you're wasting your time.
Right. She's already convinced that Jaime is irredeemable.
Right. And she feels the Hound as maybe a touch more sympathetic, maybe because of circumstance, but she sees them both as either in the sociopathic realm, mm-hmm. or on that side of the fence, to the degree that it's like, look, any good they do, because she uses sort of the, like, yeah, it's like they're doing good, or they try to do good for the helpless, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least what the, you know, their set of values are very select, they're very circumstantial. And
at least they have moments where they're trying to do that, right? But I think that in general, they're both pretty selfish people.
Right. And so the idea that because he saves Brienne from a bear, somehow we're seeing a turn, is she just thinks that's folly. And I was a little more convinced, obviously, in these episodes, but I was also a bigger point that I was trying to make, and it goes to something that you had to say about. Oh, okay, Sam. Let's say, yeah. So going back to what you said about Sam, I think that there's an element, all three of them, we can draw a parallel. You said Sam seems to be back to being more cowardly, and yeah, he's real brave when he's not at the wall, or at least he shows bravery, right?
Or at least he's brave when he can stab someone in the back.
Well, there's that, but the thing is he did go and take Gilly much to his own risk, right? And the same thing when you look at Jaime and Sam returning kind of to the confines to which they are maybe a little bit more accustomed. They fall back into their kind of standard roles, right? I mean, Jaime's, the thought being that, like, if you just remove Jaime from King's Landing, if there was a shot at redemption, that might be the way to do it.
Well, let me just say, all joking aside, sort of give Sam his due. He fled with Gilly into, like, very perilous circumstance. He killed a big baddie. He defended the woman he loves. And he came back and he basically challenged thousands of years of religious conviction. You know, all of the tradition of the Night's Watch. He reinterprets the oath. That's all very courageous. I feel like that character should have turned. And I don't want to underplay the courage of that, but your point is taken. Like, he's back, you know, he's back at this place where he can default to cowardice, right?
Right. And so, yeah, so I think that that's important for the Hound and Jaime to have that element. And you had mentioned in one of our conversations about, like, well, maybe you're trading Rob for Jaime in the narrative. And then this complicates it, right? Because it's like, well, that ain't Rob. You know, that ain't.
Yeah.
This isn't the guy that's gonna make everything better. And,
but I think that the story has been trying to make me feel more empathy and sympathy for Jaime.
Sure.
Right? You've seen him in a different light. I see his killing of the Mad King. There's an alternate story on that. Brienne's entire you know, that entire arc was supposed to humanize both of those characters. And all of a sudden he's raping his sister. Like I just.
Yeah. Cause he's the same guy that, because at the core, even if it was consensual, he's totally down for incest.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
So that's something to keep in mind, that if it was a please and thank you moment, that's still a problem. Right. so he's very flawed. If he had come back and he had resisted anything from Cersei, I would suggest, okay, well now we're cooking with a new set of ingredients. But he comes back and it's like, look, I'm not the fighter I used to be, but I'm still horny for family.
Well, you're right. I mean, Jaime's a bad dude.
His son is dead right there. I mean, that's his son, right? Let's not put that, like, we've never seen a moment of where he's ever felt like any responsibility or affection towards him. And I think that that's a pretty important element to all this, is like, he's complicated the kingdom and he doesn't even like care about the kid, or you know what I mean? Like, there's never been an element of like, yeah, that's my responsibility. Now, maybe that's typical for fathers back then, but you would think that there would be some element of like, oh, it's a shame, like my son. And Cersei seems to have to remind him of that.
Yeah, he's not great. He's not great.
But and I would argue that,
Steve.
And I'll follow Heather's lead on this one, which is to say, yeah, you probably shouldn't have started liking him.
Yeah, they did a number on me, man. They did a number on me.
I guess that's the thing, right? Like, you do have this element of keep wanting that drop of cool water, that you want that refreshing, like, come on, who am I rooting for? Because it is. I mean, like, right now we are in the midst of the who am I rooting for? Because, you know, you add the aspect of Tyrion and being accused of this, and the way things go, I mean, like, Heather's already just like, well, it's been nice knowing you. He was my favorite character, and I understand what they do to favorite characters. So she's ready to call it with Tyrion.
All right, so Tyrion's in jail, right? Pod comes in with some food, and Tyrion's just looking for someone, really anyone, to help him. He's totally helpless. And then Pod kind of reveals to Tyrion, not only can't I help you, but I actually kind of need you to run interference for me here. And so Tyrion is like, all right, so I'm in the worst predicament of my life, and I guess I gotta help you get out of the city safely.
Yeah.
You get the sense that Tyrion just has nobody.
Right.
So how do you feel about Daria?
Now I wish she was goofier.
You didn't appreciate, man, this is all on you. You did not appreciate the goofiness while you had it.
I would have been one of those guys in the focus group. They're like, hey, we're going to replace Dario. What do you think? I'm like, dude, just lose the goof. And then now I'm like, oh, man. Now he's just a guy. Sure, he can kill a horse real easy. But like, if you serve, how much different would that scene be if the dude was goofy? Like, how... Like, to me, that's even more powerful, right? I mean, like, if you're the guy's out there, you know, pissing and talking trash, mm-hmm. and he's basically one of the French knights in the Holy Grail, and then you bring out the goofball.
Mm-hmm.
See, that, I think of all this, so when it comes to sequences, the sequence that I think did the least for me, that sort of took me out of the moment, was the moment where it was like, shall I fight for you? No, we need you to do da-da-da. Yeah. Shall I fight for you? No, you're too blah, blah, blah. Can I do it? No, you're too precious. And it was just like, how about me? And I'm like, all right, just send out the goofball.
This was sort of like a Goldilocks and the Three Bears thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it felt very, very much like, is this a limerick or is this a story? Like, let's just get the guy out there already. We all know who's going to do it.
So in the book, it's this guy, Brown Ben Plum, who's
the aforementioned.
Yeah, big fat guy. He's the one that ends up doing it. And I think it's because Danny thinks if he's able to defeat, you know, the aggressor, that's better for me, but I'm not going to risk one of these other guys. And on top of that, she loves Dario at this point, or at least she's in lust with Dario at this point, and so she can't bear losing him.
Okay.
So anyway, I think that they converged those characters in that scene. I thought it was pretty effective to have Danny launch the collars of the freed slaves.
Oh yeah, that was great.
That was kind of like Allied forces dropping little pamphlets in Nazi Germany, like explaining, it's propaganda. That's what that is.
Sure.
So I thought that was good. I liked that one. In an otherwise dull episode, I really appreciated that one.
No, it was dull. I guess I disliked this one a whole lot less. I mean, I thought it was fine, but this is definitely one of those, as I call them, like the plot movers, right? I mean, there's, I don't know that there's like a singular moment that was like, oh, wow. But like, it definitely, it made you long to watch the next one because you're kind of like, all right, well, I mean, kind of moving things along here. And Littlefinger's he just out Littlefingered himself voice-wise in this particular episode, too. It was all about it.
In addition to that, he was telling everyone else how to talk.
Yeah.
He was trying to shush Dantos. He was trying to shush Sansa. Well, dude, you've had a lifetime of experience sort of whisper talking. No one's going to be as good at whispering as you, you know?
Yeah.
I just continue to hate that voice.
Oh, yeah. Is it like, what is this, like seven accents in one? What is going on?
It's like they recorded his voice and now they're playing it backwards.
Yeah, it's like, all right, now do a voice. Okay, now do a real bad impression of that same voice you just did.
So Tywin is just like matter-of-factly like standing right over the dead body of his grandson, yeah, saying,
he is this all
idiot. This fool was neither a good king or a wise king. And he's probably dead because of it. Now Let me tell you how the birds and the bees work.
What? I mean, that to me, that sequence was pretty fantastic on a lot of levels.
Yeah, Charles Dance is great.
Well, just Tywin doing what Tywin does, which is like, look, man, I'm not here to console my daughter because her feelings would fall into the category of the whims of your children, yeah, right? If you follow his previous speech. So he ain't got time for that. And he's like, look, he's doing something very valuable too, which is I'm going to secure my spot.
All right, Cersei, you seem to suck at being a mother because you ruined your first kid. I think I'm going to take over from here.
Yeah, because we're all basically at war because of your son's beheading of Ned.
That's right. Man, I guess if you're going to get the sex talk from Tywin, probably isn't the worst thing. I mean, there are worse people to give the sex talk.
Yeah, like Jamie.
Yeah, you don't want the sex talk from Jamie.
That's what. Yeah.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'll include a short conversation I had with a fellow fan. He lives in Belgium. His name is Yannick. We struck up a conversation by way of email, and he mentioned something in his email that got me thinking, and I thought, you know what? Maybe I'll include a little bit of this conversation for a Bird's Eye View. So here's my conversation with Yannick.
I wasn't expecting to get an answer so quickly, so, and I've also been listening to the podcast for years, so sure. I was like, oh, it's...
Well, I'll
talking.
Tell you what, Yannick, I will tell you that, and I'm doing, is that right, Yannick? Am I saying that?
Yannick
right?
is good.
Yeah.
He's good.
When I got your email, I thought, you know, this has got me thinking, and I wonder if there would be some benefit to hashing out a couple of these ideas voice to voice.
Yeah. So I originally read Game of Thrones for the first time after season 2 released, and I could not wait anymore. So yeah, I thought, let's read the books. I was about 20 at the time. Uh-huh. And I think I was just looking at the books with a very different mindset. Maybe a bit more classic masculinity, let's say, that the cool characters are Jon Snow, Tyrion, you know. Uh-huh. Tyrion because he's smart and witty, or a fighting badass. And maybe, I mean, I thought about this later on, that I gave characters like Caitlyn, Sansa, maybe even Davos less of a chance, because I felt like they're not cool on the surface. They're just, why are they not giving Rob a POV chapter? Why is it Caitlyn?
Yeah, sure,
Then now that 8 years later, I've also married in the time, and I've talked to my wife a lot about Game of Thrones and about these characters, and she actually asked me, how come these aren't your favorite characters? Have you ever thought about Caitlyn or...
Yeah.
And then I was like, I'll give it a chance. And I was also much more open to the world because I had also been watching a lot of Game of Thrones, reading a lot of theories.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I really saw how good, especially the Caitlyn chapters were, and how interesting. I understood how the world was working, like how she manipulates the phrase, or how she... For instance, that she knows how to talk to them to have a good wedding relationships. It's so funny to have this mindset switch that they turn into my more favorite characters.
Well, I have a question about this, and I'm glad you brought the sort of the masculinity thing into it, because that's where I wanted to go with it. Mm-hmm. So you said that you first read these books when you're around 20.
Yeah.
And it's almost a decade later, right?
Almost a decade later, yeah.
Yeah, almost a decade later, and you're older and you're wiser.
And I think so
here's my question, and I'm interested in it because I've explored this in my own life as well, and I wonder if there is some sort of thing about your relationship to your own masculinity that hindered you from liking these female characters early on. And so now that you can look back and reflect on that, I don't want to say misogyny, but I just want to ask, like, is there something there that's worth critiquing?
I think that it's mainly, let's say, with role models. And I think that there's a lot of male role models out there. And I think me as a teenager, it was never like, oh, there could also be a female role model to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a small mindset change. Like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to have a woman as a role model than a man for a change?
Isn't it odd that it takes so long to learn these lessons? And it seems so obvious in retrospect, right?
Yeah, very, very sure. And I mean, it also took me to get married because it's also because of the person I married, because she's, let's say, she's more vocal in these things, that I started to think about it more. At least had to.
I'm glad we're talking about this. Because I felt like I didn't like Sansa at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in retrospect, I can appreciate her in a different way. Mm-hmm. But I felt like, for me, she was just so horrible to Arya.
Definitely, yeah.
That I didn't really sort of give credit to her own sort of survival techniques.
Yep.
So you say that you didn't like Sansa early on, but now you're appreciating her differently now.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing a different kind of braveness. You know, I think Arya really has this braveness. Hey, I'm going to go out and I'm going to stab you. While Sansa needs to learn how to survive in her own way. Mm-hmm. So she's got to make use of different tools that she has.
I feel like, and this is sort of a self-critique here, you know, me saying that I love Arya and then I hated Sansa early on. I think for me, I think I might have used that as a shield to say, no, I don't dislike Sansa because of her gender, because of course I love Arya. Mm-hmm. But then there's that additional thing of like, well, do I love Arya because she presents with more masculine characteristics than Sansa does? Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that made her more interesting. And then, of course, then the question is, well, why do I find those characteristics more interesting?
Yeah, the rabbit hole goes deeper. So, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Anyway, I thought, hey, here's someone that would be interested in talking that through with me. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, definitely.
My thanks to Yannick for that conversation. Just one final note. I wonder if we might be served by reconsidering what we would consider a male characteristic or a female characteristic. So a bit of self-critique of the self-critique here. You never know what's going to happen when you email me at book@baldmove.com. And that is all for this week.